This is the Working Drummer Podcast, featuring conversations with ground-level pros from all styles and regions. Real drummers with real stories about making a living in music.
Hey everyone, welcome to Working Drummer Podcast. I'm Zach Albetta, and this week I'm talking with Rob Perkins. Over his career, Rob has played with Michael Bublé, Tierney Sutton, and many others. But from an early age, he has also been active as a contractor, amassing a huge Rolodex of fellow musicians whom he uses to staff up live music events of all kinds. He's still active as a performer in and around Los Angeles, but he has left the road behind, and his primary role is now that of contractor and founder of On the Beat Music Agency. We have tons of Patreon content for you to check out, and you can get access to all of it for a buck a month. Matt and I are now doing monthly installments of the two of us just catching up a bit about recent guests and whatever else, and our old buddy Matt Iceman is soon going to be contributing some video content. As always, there are video lessons, transcriptions, and bonus interview content from our former guests. Once again, a donation of $1 a month gets you access to everything at patreon.com/workingdrummer. So Rob and I knew each other a little bit from when I lived in LA, and he reached out to me recently wondering if talking about what he does as a contractor would be useful to the Working Drummer audience, and the answer was absolutely yes. Whether you're just starting out or you're well established in your career and on your scene, Rob has a lot of wisdom and insight about the nuts and bolts of working your way into a scene and creating relationships that lead to sustainable work. He sees the whole field from both sides of the live music equation, the musicians who do the playing and the non-musicians who write the checks, and what each side wants and needs out of that interaction and how everybody can go home happy. Lots to dig into here, so let's get to it. Here's Rob Perkins. We crossed paths a couple of times when I lived in LA. I came to see you play once or twice. I think you hired me a time or two for like the Hotel Casa Del Mar. So it seems like when I was there, like I was in LA from 2010 to the end of 2015, and it seemed like you were sort of just getting going with the contracting booking agency thing. And, you know, leading up to that, you had amassed, you know, quite a resume as a drummer in your own right, which, you know, a couple of those highlights I definitely want to get into. But just talk about sort of the process you went through and the transition from being, you know, a working drummer, that's your primary source of income, to, you know, the contracting agency you have now.
The contracting nature of what I do started for me super early, and that made the transition a lot smoother. But to give just a little bit of why, the backstory of how it started, like I was a freshman at USC. I was a scholarship freshman at USC who auditioned from a distance, and I think I was a very sore disappointment to the faculty once I showed up in person, where we're kind of like all I had together. This is 1993, so I had like my Weckl play-alongs and everything that, you know, like I could really, really nail that stuff, but that had nothing to do with like playing Splanky in the big band and, you know, Corner Pocket. That didn't serve the purposes out here whatsoever. So I am very much aware that I think faculty there was kind of trying to figure out, what do we do with this kid here that we just gave all this scholarship money to? And I was literally standing in the office one day when someone higher up in the department found themselves on the phone with some alumni who wanted to book a band, you know, and they didn't want to deal with it. And I just happened to be standing there. And this particular person was the person who awarded me the scholarship. And I was aware of the contradiction. And he just kind of looked at me. He's like, you deal with this. Take this call. They want a big band. Set it up. You know? And I was like, I don't know how to. Yeah, I don't know how to. Yeah, they want a big band. Set it up. Like, but also acutely aware that I still needed to prove my worth here. And so in the middle of my fluster, in the moment, he says, set it up and give me half. And that's what I was like, what with the who now? What? Yeah. And give me half. And that was like, I'm not sure I'm supposed to do that, but what do you mean here? He's like, what do you charge? And I just kind of covered the phone, like, what do I charge? He says, doesn't matter what you charge. This first thing I never heard, first time I ever heard of anything like that. It's like, doesn't matter. The people who are calling, who are making this phone call, they don't care. Doesn't matter. Right. Pick a number, yeah, kind of thing, you know? So that clued me into that's where work comes from. Mm-hmm. That's where good work comes from. That's where people find work. That's, we're not just always knocking on doors, banging on doors, making phone calls, trying to like walk into the bar and say, hey, I got a band, you know? That, so that got my attention very, very, very early on. And that maintained, so I ended up being, that ended up being my job in the jazz department for 4 years. I became the guy to take those calls and develop that skill. And then that just kind of maintained that throughout everything that I did. I moved back and forth between LA and New York a handful of times and tried to like dabble a little bit in New York. And I always sort of had a little something going on here in LA for some reasons. So
let me just stop you for a second. If if I'm understanding, like people, like during your USC years, people would call the USC music department and just looking for bands, looking for music, for events or whatever. Yep. And you became sort of the point man for like booking students to play professional gigs.
Exactly.
Amazing.
And that was so educational. And I didn't know that is a thing that exists. You're an alumni from this school, and I'm having a Christmas party. You know,
right.
I have my T's and sickens, my season tickets to the USC football games. I'm a Trojan through and through. Whatever the school is, I'm a supporter of such and such. I'm going to spend some money here. I'm going to spend some money on my old alma mater. You know. And the people, there is a section of the world who are making those decisions, and they don't really care too much what it costs, you know? So that became a skill and a thing that I did for 4 years there all throughout my undergrad. There was someone who was about to graduate who had been doing that job, a fantastic bass player out here named Zach Matthews, who had been doing that job as a grad student. And so we had a little bit of an overlap time of him training me into doing the job and showed me how to do it, gave me some contract templates and talked about some negotiation and getting information up front, yada, yada, and started making a whole bunch of mistakes that I was fortunate enough to learn from.
Right.
Just got in there, got some mud on me and made the mistakes and started to figure it out.
Right.
My professional path from coming out of being like a high school kid into Los Angeles was married very quickly with learning how to be a drummer, but also freshman in school, starting to learn how to be booking guy.
Right.
And then, the phone would ring. I'm having a Christmas party. My kid's having a bat mitzvah. My this is that, my that, you know, whatever kind of, I just want a piano player. Mm-hmm. I think my second year there, I did a big band for a Quincy Jones, he had something called Seventh Level Productions. And I found myself way over my head. Like this was a big party. But at the time, like Greg Field was faculty at USC and John Thomas, we had like so much Basie alumni.
Right.
So kind of on faculty. So like, hey, let me talk to Quincy's people about Basie alumni stuff. And like the deal was done at that point.
Yeah.
And off we go. Yeah.
Wow. Crazy.
Yeah.
So like over the course of your career, you've mentioned you've sort of like done this contracting thing all along, you know, to various degrees in different ways in different cities. At what point do you decide like I'm going to create this agency? And because it's, is it On the Beat Music Agency?
On the Beat Music Agency. So I, you know, the goal was to be drummer. The goal was always to be like, I wanted to get on a great gig and get out on the road and do the thing and, you know, get the endorsements and have, you know, playing behind great artists and just be drummer in the way that all of our heroes that we look up to our heroes as we're coming up and wanting to all be drummers.
All of which you did.
kind of ended up largely doing. And then I met my wife, which is a common story, but I met my wife, who's from Sydney, Australia. I met her, we had a night off, we were traveling, and I met her, who is also a musician and producer, and just started challenging me on what I thought was achievable for life career stuff. I think I was, this is 2005, I was born in 75, I think I was 30. Mm-hmm. And far as I was concerned, I received everything I'd ever asked the universe for. Mm-hmm. I was good. I wasn't going to push my luck. I wasn't going to like, I'm good. I've got enough to support like a little one bedroom apartment. I was living in New York at the time. I'm good. You know, I'm not asking for any more than this. I'm just going to ride this out and retire being the road guy. Yeah. And then she started to poke and prod and challenge of like, well, what about being able to travel without the artist paying for it? Mm-hmm. What about owning a home instead of renting a place? What about having some kids and being able to take care of them? What, you know, why not ask for more? Yeah. And I had put down the booking thing a bit, and that started to inspire me to kind of pick it up again a little bit and see what I could make happen and reactivate a bit there. And I think we met in 2005. I think I left the road in like 2013. And so it's probably like 2009. We moved back out here to LA that I started getting some stuff going, running the booking business from the road, doing everything that I was doing while traveling and while touring, which was not easy and made me very not ready. Yeah, made me very not present in the road other than showing up for sound check and gig and then going back away into my cave to do my stuff, which is not great for me. You know, we talk about the things that keep a gig. But then eventually it grew and it was doing just as well for me and the people that I was hiring as the road gig at the time. So that transition then started to feel like it was approaching, and that happened to line up with a break, like a out, you know, one out and tour is finished, and there's going to be a whole bunch of time off before the next one goes on, and then just never came back.
Right.
which was a scary, professional period of time that required a whole, well, it took a lot of sleepless nights, took a whole ton of fear, risk, letting go of something that I'd built for a lifetime, walking away from a goal, deciding like, I'm not going to go do another road gig. I'm not going to, you know, chances of finding something like that again are pretty slim. By that time, I'm 35, I don't know, 40. I'm terrible with, like I said, I can't remember the years, you know?
Right, right.
So,
and the road gig you're referring to was Michael Bublé, correct?
The Bublé gig at the time. Yep.
Right, right.
And then, yeah, whenever he had breaks, I'd be spending time at home working on this, building this up, but also picking up little tours, trying to reconnect with old friends that I used to play with as much as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you're touching on something that I think a lot of musicians grapple with is it feels like a huge risk and also like a very limiting box to commit yourself entirely to one thing, because most of us are doing a bunch of different shit all the time, right? Like a bunch of different kinds of gigs, some corporate gigs, some creative stuff, some live, some recording, some teaching, some, you know, and we don't love all of it, but there's strength in numbers, right? exactly. In terms of like diversifying your income. And it happened for me on this gig. Like I was, you know, I was offered this gig and it's like, you're going to do this and only this for, you know, a year. And I struggled with that a little bit. I didn't struggle with it for too long because very quickly I was like, what are you fucking dumb? This is the biggest, coolest opportunity you've ever been offered.
with some great music.
Right. But there was that moment of pause. Yeah, like, do I want to put myself in this box? So for you, I would imagine like letting go of, you know, just sort of the quote unquote more secure. It's at least more psychologically secure to be out and gigging and touring and all that. And to just leave it behind. Like, I'm sure that that caused a lot
and to leave it behind for, at that point, the entirety of what I did was all just gigs around town, hotel lobbies, lounges, single piano players. It was all the type of work that musicians historically are going to get fired from. There is not stability from, you know what I mean?
Right.
The rates are going to get cut. Someone's going to come in and offer to do it for cheaper. Someone's going to do the wrong thing. It was for this like element of the scene that is not stable. And I was drawn to this instinct that I felt like what this little neighborhood of the scene needs is some stability. Mm-hmm. Like the clients want music. The musicians want to play the music for money, but they don't know how to like engage with each other. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be someone who's going to walk in and offer to do it for cheaper. There's going to be someone who's going to make a fuss about this, that, the other. Like, we will get fired. So what can I do to kind of like, what can I gonna do to like prolong something so that there isn't this constant turnover and rates dropping and yada, yada, yada. Like, stop the bleeding and then try to grow from there.
Right.
It was a really knowing that I was walking into like this, there's no stability here, but the value that I feel like I have to offer is potentially the ability to establish some stability and then try to improve incrementally from there.
So what specifically did you do, implement that stability? I would imagine you had work to do, you know, with the musicians as well as, you know, the people who are doing the hiring, whether they're club owners or fathers of the bride or whatever. Like you mentioned, these two types of people just have trouble communicating. So what was some of the connective tissue that you were able to build out?
The first move that I made, and this was the most emotionally challenging move, is to refuse to play the jobs myself, that I will never go play my own job, that I have to remain an open ear of an avenue for the client to speak to without them being concerned with hurting my feelings. Mm-hmm. So if they're like, I feel like the drummer's too loud, you know what I mean? They're not, if I'm the drummer playing, they're not going to come and tell me. They're going to be like, hey man, great to see you. Thanks for being here. I'm not calling you again. Like giving them an objective, a referee, a middle person that they could open up to and talk to about their needs, wants, and desires, what their goals are, without them being worried about me personally having something personally invested, so that I could then go and hopefully actuate what they're trying to achieve for them. Mm-hmm. So that part was hard because I want to play.
Right.
And start hiring all my favorite people in the world, the people I really, really want to play with, but saying I'm going to be there standing in the back, standing next to the manager, and I'm not touching that instrument.
Mm-hmm.
That sucks.
Yeah, sure.
That sucks. So it's like kind of putting the thing I love the most on the sacrificial altar a little bit.
Right.
Like, okay,
right.
I'm giving you this so that I can hopefully serve in a different capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's client facing, and then musician facing, just removing all risk, just saying, starting with pay, no matter what happens here, you guys are getting paid. If I take a loss, the client gets squirrely, whatever happens, no matter what happens on this gig, on this week, on this month, you guys are getting paid. You're getting taken care of. There's going to be someone there who's going to listen to you, who's going to understand what you're trying to do, who's going to try to marry what you are looking for to make yourself have a good night with what they're looking for. And that still is, they don't always believe me. They don't always be like, you're going to get taken care of. If the client screws us, you're taken care of, and I'm going to step in front of it, and it's going to be fine, mm-hmm. and yada, yada, yada. And just starting to coach them into, you can show up and play the music we've talked about and do the thing we've discussed and not really have to worry about much else. And sometimes, even when there would be conflicting messages from a manager or seemingly conflicting messages from a manager, the manager approaches the piano player and says, hey, you guys are doing too much of that. Can I have a little bit more of this? First thing the piano player does, their shoulder goes up and like, oh crap, we're not getting paid. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, oh crap, there's risk here. They're going to screw us. This is going to go bad. You know what I mean? And so it takes a long time of like, you're good. Don't worry about it. It's fine. Try to do what they're asking you for, but you're going to be fine.
Right.
So establishing trust on both sides of the thing mm-hmm. was and continues to be, I think, the most valuable thing that I can bring to the table.
Yeah.
And in a unique position if I was on the road for 9 years. So I had a little bit of a piggy bank to be able to say, if this goes bad, I'm going to step in front of it and make sure everyone's good. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to, because one time of saying to the guys, like, sorry, guys, we got screwed. We're not getting paid tonight. They're never coming back. They're never. Right. That's it. So being willing to be like, I'm going to take this job, understanding that if we make zero from it, I'm still going to be sending people home that says, Rob took good care of us. We're coming out next time he calls.
Yeah. Yeah. You use the word coach or coaching, and you know what you're describing reminds me of the idea in sports of being a player's coach, right? There's this idea of, and a lot of times those coaches are former players, so they have buy-in and trust with the players under them because those guys know, like, you know, this person has done what we're doing.
They've walked those steps before. They know exactly, yeah.
Right.
And I kind of feel like us as drummers, that's our gig. We need to extract the best performance out of the singer that we can. Mm-hmm. We need to light a fire. We need to frame them perfectly. We need them to deliver the best set of music so that we can work next week, so that we can continue to activate our business.
Yeah.
So we're back there trying to do everything we can because we can't sing, we can't dance, we can't entertain as much as they can. We're back there doing everything we can to make this thing go great mm-hmm. so that that person will get hired again and then they'll hopefully hire us again.
That's so interesting.
It's a similar thing.
I love that that sort of comparison or whatever you want to call it, because you're right. As drummers, I think in particular with singers, like we have to really read the room and really read the singer. And like you said, sometimes we got to like kick them in the ass and light a fire under them. Sometimes we have to just like read some body language and slow the tempo down, just like whatever it is they need to feel comfortable. Like a good drummer will be really keyed into all that. So those skills, those sort of empathetic, personal soft skills, apply directly, I think, to what you're talking about, whether you've got to, you know, manage a club owner who is pissed off about something or a pianist who's pissed off about something, you know, you with your drumming skills that you've honed over the years, you can say, I see what you need. I hear your concern. I can handle it.
Yep. My entire reason, entire reasons for doing what I do comes from, I come from a place of starvation. I come from a place of like being broke, and being stuck behind the drums, watching band leaders ruin the gig and not being able to do anything about it.
Yeah. You know?
And being stuck back there and being like, I need us to be here next Thursday night. And because you just threw a temper tantrum because your hamburger came out 10 minutes late, you just threw a little temper tantrum about that. We're not going to be here next Thursday night. And I'm not paying rent. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, and being stuck and be like, I'm screwed. You're such a good sax player. You're such a good singer. You're such a good everything. You're one of the best everything in the world. But you just threw a temper tantrum about your hamburger. And now I'm not making rent.
Right.
You know
what I mean? Right.
So that extends to like, there was an instinct that I had to not be trapped behind the drums anymore, where I could help to influence things, mm-hmm. to not be stuck back there, so I can stand next to the manager, so I can go and tip the kitchen staff in advance, be like, hey, I know you guys are slammed. Here's $20. My band's going to take a break in 10 minutes. Can you fly it out for me?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I can get in front of this stuff a little bit, so that, hey, everyone went home happy, and nobody really knows why they went home happy, but just like...
Right.
But just like being on the drum kit, like when you watch your singer come in and you're like, ooh, they had a bad day. Mm-hmm. All right, I got to get them in a good spot. I've got to get them into a good place. And they're going to, then if I can get them to a place where they have a great night, they may not exactly know what I did, but they will go home and having had a great night, and I will have been the drummer on the gig. And they're going to think, like, every time I'm around that guy, I feel good.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They're not going to think like, man, I love the way that he made sure that it's that those hits are only on the second time through the A section, that he didn't play them on the first time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They're going to go home thinking like, you know what? I feel like I walked in that room and I was a little bit worried because I had a crappy day, and I was a little bit worried that I was going to have a bad interaction with the venue host or whomever. And I went home and they gave me a big hug, and I associate this good feeling with such and such.
Yep.
And
totally.
That's what, that kind of subject is what led me to, I was like, I feel like I want to talk to Zach about this stuff. Cause I love just the title of your podcast is The Working Drummer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like the celebrated artist drummer.
Right.
It's the working drummer, the guys who are out there practicing this traditional time-honored trade of being hired to come in and do the work. Not yep. necessarily the guys who are playing in the thrash punk band and throwing their drums around after the end of the gig,
right.
but the guys who are out there pounding the pavement, developing their brand, their voice, their list of styles, and what it takes to get working, stay working, and grow your business of working. And that's something that, from coming from a place of starvation to a place where now I'm trying to hire drummers to do that kind of thing, I was like, I feel like I want to have this conversation.
Over 450 interviews, and we've talked at length about doing all kinds of gigs, and especially the ones you're talking about, just the sort of day in, day out, week in, week out,
just,
you know, hotel, lounge, wedding, what it like, that's the sustaining
yep.
gigs. That's the sustaining money that just sort of keeps a lot of people going. But we've never really talked to the other side of that equation, right? The people who are making these gigs happen, and making sure not only that they happen, but that they A, go well, so that B, they can continue to happen, right?
Yep.
Because it's one thing to be able to book a gig. I think, you know, anybody, we've all probably been, you know, found ourselves in a situation where we're the contractor, right? Like some family member or somebody we know, it's like, oh yeah, Zach can put it together. And very quickly you find out like how many moving parts there are, how many, factors, logistics, you know, all that. And it takes someone doing it really well for everybody to come out happy. It like everyone coming out happy doesn't happen by accident. It takes someone seeing the whole field and working all the personalities and all of the interests. So yeah, I'm really glad we get to do this.
And there's so much mystery behind it. There's so much, and where there is mystery, there's distrust.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much like, well, who's really making what, and how's this all working, and we're getting screwed, like you got both sides sitting there saying, I'm getting screwed.
Right.
You know what I mean? Which, so like if everyone genuinely believes they're getting screwed, how do we get everyone going home feeling like, you know what? I feel good about what just happened here. And if they're not going home feeling that way, that's where we have to get involved. So like the, like you're saying, we all will eventually find ourselves in this position of like a family member, someone reached out to us to say, hey, I'm throwing my parents an anniversary party. Can you put together a quintet for me?
Right.
You just spent X amount of time negotiating with the people who want to throw it. They don't like the same styles of music. One of them wants to have a party. The other one doesn't want to have a party. One of them wants a DJ. The other one wants a live band. One wants jazz. The other one really wants Motown. But cousin Jimmy is a salsa fan, so can they play a little salsa too, right? And you've just like gone through all of this stuff, right? Yeah. And then you're like, all right, I got this gig. It's Saturday night. It's from 8 to 11. I'm so excited. I've got $200 a guy. I'm going to go call my guys. You know what I mean? And you call the one guy who's like, man, I don't work for $200. You know what I mean? And you've just like cooked this steak. You've gone to the butcher. You've brought it home. You've seasoned it. You've like cooked the most beautiful steak in the world. You've bought it. You put it on the plate of your favorite person. And there's like, I'm not eating that.
Yep.
I'm not doing that. How would you dare approach me with $200? You know what I mean?
Right.
And that's one of the skill sets that I feel like I've been looking for the opportunity to say to more than one person at a time of like, how do you say no? What's the right way to say no to something?
Mm-hmm.
Because you who just did everything you could to deliver the steak and the person's like, is that grass fed?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, what's the right way to say no to something? And what's the right way to say yes to something in the ways that will make that person be like, if you are not interested in the thing that I just brought you, how do you send me away thinking like, ooh, the next time I have a steak and some lobster, I'm bringing it to Zach. You know what
right.
I mean? Like, how
right.
do you send me away that's like, man, that I feel really good about the fact that I just reached out to this person.
I love the idea of finding the right way to say no and the right way to say yes, because there are wrong ways to do both of those that can end up like hurting you and not serving you. So like if you come to me with the $200 gig and I say, I don't play for $200, that poisons the well. Like you are not going to call, like even if you have a really cool gig for $150 that I'd be perfect for, that I would have a blast on, you're not calling me because I was just a dick about like, I don't play for $200. Right. So,
and
like,
I'm not coming to you for 400. At right. that point. You
yes, know what I mean? Exactly.
I'm right? not coming to you.
Yeah.
You
know what I mean? Shitty right. attitude. You're
I'm not
done.
Coming to you.
Yeah. So, and then, so, you know, to, and then to say yes, the right way. I want to talk about Bobby Watson, 'cause I know you played with him some, and he was my grad school mentor in Kansas City. And one of the many nuggets of wisdom that he gave us was, you're not too good for any gig you say yes to.
Exactly.
So,
and any gig that someone offers you, like, you know, if someone calls you for $50, they're not telling you that they think you're worth $50. That's not, they're not, a lot of people hear it as like, this person thinks I'm only worth $50.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the message. They're bringing you the best they got.
Right.
You know what I mean? They've worked hard. It's so hard to get a $50 gig. It's actually easier to get a $5,000 gig. It's so hard to get a $50 gig because you're like walking into the bar and asking the bartender, can you talk to the manager? And they're like, oh, come on, man.
Right.
You know what I mean? You have to like generate a $50 gig from where there wasn't a gig already.
Yes.
No one already has a $50 gig. You have to go and convince someone to come out and spend their $200 for a quartet that they did not intend on spending.
Right.
You have to create that from, it's so hard. So when someone approaches you with a $50 gig, and I want to, it's not that they're assuming your worth, and you have to remember how hard they just worked to create that. You mm-hmm. have to remember, like, they are so excited to bring you this thing. They just dug up a truffle from the backyard, and not everyone knows the value of a truffle, you know
right.
what I mean? But like they've just dug up this little nugget and they're so excited to bring it to you. And we have to be careful about communicating, how dare you approach me with that, or get out of here with that. And we have to be careful with communicating, I can't believe you went and took that gig to someone else. You know what I mean? Everyone has their right and their reasons and their own freedom to take something for certain reasons and not take things for certain reasons. And so like, what, and Bobby is absolutely right. You're not too good for anything you say yes to. It's so absolutely right. And there are so many reasons to say no, and the ways to say no, and even times to say yes to certain things that you wouldn't normally say yes to.
Right.
So I want to come back to saying yes and no real quick, but like, taking the example, like, fortunately in today's world, there aren't that many $50 gigs left, whatever it be, $75, $100, $150 gigs, you know? There are so many reasons. We'll leave it at 50. There's so many reasons to take a $50 gig that no one considers. And this is sort of how I got myself working. If you're a newbie, you're just graduated, you're about to graduate, you're just trying, you're in your early 20s, you're trying to get working, someone brings you a $50 gig. Hopefully you really don't need $50 that much. Hopefully it's not really, you don't need that money, right? But you really want people to hear you. You really want people to get to know you. You really want people to have the opportunity to hear that you can play and that you're great to be around and that you have value to add to the thing.
Right.
So first question, who's playing bass? Have you called a bass player yet?
Yeah.
You mean, have you called a bass player yet? With any luck, they haven't called a bass player. Would you mind if I called a bass player? Would you mind if I would love to come and do this with you. Would you mind if I called a bass player? I would really just like to take this opportunity to like bring you a team that I feel is great.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you don't need the $50. So you start calling bass players who you think might work for $100. Call those bass players and say, hey man, I really want to play with you. I thought about maybe calling you for a lesson. I really want to get on the bandstand with you. I want to feel that quarter note. I want to feel your groove. I want you to hear me. You're someone I've had my eye on for a long time. I've got this gig. It pays $50, but I'm never going to ask you to do that. Can you come and do this gig for $100? I want to get on the bandstand with you and see how that feels. And I want to have that experience. And transparently, I want you to hear me play.
Right.
You know I mean, like, you are the kind of bass player that I really want to hook up with. That guy is going to say, I like that, I'm coming.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're going to say, I can't do it, but I really respect that you made that call and that I'm someone that you want to play with. What's your name again?
Right.
Yeah. What's your name again? Who are you? You know, I'll tell you what, I'm playing next Thursday over at such and such. Come by and say, hey, you know, come hang out. I want to introduce you to such and such, yada, yada, yada. You know, if you're smart, that's what you do with a $50 gig. And if you're lucky, the first person you call says no. And if you're lucky, the second person you call says no. And if you're lucky, you can make 12 of those calls. So you've got 12 bass players who have just received this call that says like, hey, my name's Rob Perkins. I'm kind of a new drummer in town. I'm such a huge fan of your playing. I really want to play with you. Would you consider coming and doing this thing with me? You know?
Right.
You don't want the first guy to say yes. You want him to say no so that you can make more of those calls. You now have 12 guys who are like, man, that kid wants to play. That kid's willing to do whatever, you know?
Right.
And then on the other side of the spectrum, sort of like the reasons to say yes and like how both people can view the same thing with different values.
Mm-hmm.
You are like a super established vet. You're a super established, you've toured, you've done this, you've been in the magazines, you've got the everything, yada, 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 right? You late 40s, and you feel like stuff is like, I don't want to go back on the road anymore. Stuff is slowing down. I'm not making great money in town here as much as like, I shouldn't be playing these $200 gigs. I don't know, it doesn't make any sense, but got to make a buck. And someone calls you for $50, you know? You have to say like, who's on the gig? You know, and then consider taking that gig, going in, dressing like $1 million, learning the music in advance, and blowing that gig out of the water. making those kids experience, they're probably going to be a bunch of kids, making their experience the best freaking musical experience they've ever had with this legend. They know who you are. And some of those kids next year or the year after, they're going to start getting some $5,000-$7,000 gigs. They're going to start getting some stuff. And you will be the legend from that one night who you just came in and marketed yourself to amongst all these people. One of them's going to get a call for a family wedding that's got a huge budget. One of them's going to have a cousin with a dad who's producing a record. And they're going to be like, man, I think I can get John Smith to come and do this. Man, I remember I played this thing with him and he was amazing. He was the best thing that ever happened, you know? That is like, that's your pipeline of new business. That's not, I'm worth 50 bucks. You are developing a pipeline for what's going to keep you busy 2 years later and 3 years later, because those guys are going to find some gigs.
Right.
And the pipeline, your competition.
What's running through the pipeline is relationships. Like we've said it 1,000 times on this podcast, this business is built on relationships. Like get the word networking out of your mouth and replace it with creating relationships. So you just illustrated how almost no matter who you are, a $50 gig can generate relationships, or at least the beginnings of relationships, and so much goodwill amongst people you want to play with, people who can get you work. And like you said, you know, the guy who's offering you the $50 gig today could very well be offering you the $5,000 gig in a year or two. And if you create goodwill and relationships now, they will pay dividends later. I'm so glad you illustrated that. And you also mentioned like showing up and killing the gig, going back to what Bobby said about you're not too good for any gig you say yes to. It took me a long time to, understand this and understand what it means. If you say yes to a gig, treat it with the same respect that you would treat any other gig in terms of the preparation you do for it, in terms of the attitude you bring to it, because I've been guilty of this and I'm sure a bunch of other people have too. Like you've said yes to this gig. It seems like bullshit. The money isn't great. Like everything about the gig just feels kind of like Mickey Mouse. So you use that as a permission structure to not bring your best self to it in terms of how you prepare, in terms of how you play, in terms of how you interact with other people. You just act as if the gig is beneath you. Now, it might very well be beneath you. And in that case, it's okay to say no to the gig. If you think a gig is beneath you, say no to it. Don't say yes to it and then act like it's beneath you.
I've had so many interactions where someone will bring $150 worth of value to a $150 gig. Mm-hmm. And I know that their value of what they are capable of doing in terms of music prep, concentration, the way they dress, arriving on time, that their professional value is a standard that is we all should be aspiring to. But because this one pays $150, sweatpants and yada, yada, yada.
Right.
And there are people that I can't hire anymore. There are people that I can't afford anymore. There are people that have far outgrown my ability to reach them.
Yeah.
And the reason I can't reach them anymore is because they have certain business practices that are what we're talking about, like what Bobby outlines of like, when I show up, you're going to get the most amazing experience. And that's never going to change. My brand for when I come to your situation, you're going to get the most amazing thing. And there's never going to be a dip in that. Mm-hmm. And at some point, I lose those people. I can't get them anymore.
Right.
Because
they
graduate. Their careers. Yeah. And they also know to like, they come and play with me 6 times a year. Mm-hmm. They know to develop their pipeline of business to, because there's going to be the next musical director for the Emmys or something that'll be musical directing, you know, the Emmys in 15 years is probably playing in one of my bands. Mm-hmm. You
know what I mean? Right.
And so they know to come and like hang out and just be around and deliver that level of service because.
Right. And in addition to sort of looking forward at the, you know, the next potential big gig in that way, you know, coming back and playing with your stuff a few times a year also like maintains the relationship so that, you know, if and when their big gig goes away, they can come back to you and know that they can play with good musicians, make some good money, have a good experience. It's not, you know, going on the world tour or whatever, but it's that sustainable work that we talked about that just keeps you going and fills the gaps.
I want to give you and your listeners an example of like the best no that I've ever had. And there's like, there's several people that give me versions of this no, you know, and it's effectively like, if I'm lazy or I'm busy or I'm in a rush, I really try to use the phone. But if I'm lazy and busy and rush, I'll shoot a text out. Hey man, can you make this thing Friday night, it's 8 to 11, pays $250. The response is, Rob, can I call you in 10 minutes? Right? Mm-hmm. They call. Rob, how you doing? Good, good, good. How's your family? Everything's great. What you been doing? Cool, cool, cool. Man, Rob, I saw you posted this thing where you were checking out, or like, say you called me. Like, hey, Zach, man, I saw that post you just put up about you got some new hi-hat cymbals. I know that feeling. I love that feeling so much, man. Like, God, I can identify. It's like new shoes on the first day of school kind of thing. Like, you just want to, you know what I mean? Like, They sounded great. Those cymbals you got were killer. And I noticed the recording you got somehow. I don't know if it was a board mix. That recording was killer. I'm not talking about me here at all. I'm talking like, Zach, that thing with the hi-hat cymbals, and man, in touch a crash cymbal, like might as well put the crash cymbals away. When I get a new pair of hats, I'm not touching anything else. I just want to play. I'm just talking about Zach, and how great it was that you did on that video. And man, I noticed, dude, 14 months, you've been out there doing that thing. I'm going to ask you about your experience in the tour. I'm talking about anything other than myself. I'm talking about you. I already know I'm going to say no to the gig, but talking about things I've noticed that you do that I like, that I can identify with, talking about things that you are doing that, man, I know you're keeping it together out on there on the road, and I know that's not easy. And I know it takes a whole lot of mental discipline, and you got to stay in touch with your physical shape, your emotion, you know, still just talk. I already know I'm going to say no, but we're still just talking about you, you know? And then like, listen, I can't make that one, but I can't tell you how much it means to me that you called me for that. There are so many amazing drummers in this town. The fact that you thought of me and called me for it, that I'm anywhere on that list for that gig, thank you so, so much for thinking of me. Can I help you find someone? Do you need any help finding anybody? Because I will happily make some phone calls for you. Now, if you say no, cool. But I've offered and I've told you like, I know who you are. I'm interested in what you do. I'm paying attention to what you do. And goodness gracious, thank you so much for thinking of me. I would love to play that. Hey, what are you guys playing? It's a blues gig. Woo, have you ever, remember Buddy Miles? You know, like, what are you guys playing? I want to talk to you. We're going to talk about some stuff that I love about that style of music. It's a salsa gig. Man, I remember I used to study such and such, and I used to check out these records. And have you ever heard such and such? I'm going to let you know that I know something about that music.
Yeah.
I'm going to let you know that like, you called me already, but I'm going to let you know, I used to check out such and such and I was so into it and yada, yada, yada. I can't make it. Thank you so much for thinking of me. Can I help you make some calls? Even if you say no, then you've still just had like a great little interaction. Hopefully you've had a great interaction with me. And the next time you get an opportunity, I'm going to be one of the numbers that you call.
Yes.
And if you say yes, I'm using my bass player trick. I'm calling a bunch of drummers like, hey man, I thought of you. I've got this great gig that I think would be great for you. You're yada, yada, yada. I saw this thing that you checked out. You were playing this salsa thing that you were nailing, blah, blah, blah. I think I should connect you with such and such. Like, if I'm not happy with your $250 rate, I have the potential of generating so many relationships and income out of that phone call.
Mm-hmm. Right. And everything you're talking about is like, yes, there's this gig and whether or not I'm going to do it, but your interaction is about the relationship first and the gig second. Because your relationship encompasses all the gigs, right? from now till eternity, right? So if you nurture that and just don't make it about that one gig. And what you described is a very outgoing and extroverted approach. I love the idea of actually getting on the phone, right? Instead of text responding like, hey, I can't make it, sorry. But you know, if not all of us have it in us to go down that extroverted road, you know, I can speak for a moment from the introvert's perspective. Like, you can still maintain that relationship, even if it's in a text, right? You can do a shorter version of this in a text, like, hey man, it's great to hear from you. I hope you're well. Thank you so much for thinking of me. Like, I can't make this one, but please keep me in mind. You know, there's a short, compact, introverted version of everything you're talking about.
And here's a link to this video you posted of this thing that was super killer.
Right.
Like, and dude, by the way, I was checking this out. So killer. Yep. So killer, man. I love how you do that. You know?
Yep. Yep.
Instead of the response of like, sorry, man, I'm booked that night.
Right. And so this is another thing about saying no. Like, you can say no without saying why you're saying no.
Yeah.
Right. If whether the money isn't good enough, or you know that bass player sucks, or, you know, like whatever reason you have for not wanting to do the gig, like, you can keep it to your fucking self, and you can just be polite and professional and say, I'm sorry, I can't make it. And why you can't make it is none of their fucking business.
And why be pinned down to that stated reason?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Because now, like, if they, you know, if they know you hate that bass player, then that doesn't reflect well on you.
So like, and even more condensed, I would so love to make that gig. Thank you for thinking of me. I can't make it that night. Please think of me again next time. You know? And that bass player, there is a specific bass player who came, I want to avoid names, but who came from LA and is now in New York playing with all of my favorite people in the world. And he's so good. But when he was knocking around LA, my pompous, arrogant self was like, I don't like that guy. I don't want to play with that guy. I don't, if it's such and such on the gig, I don't want to do the thing. I don't want to, like, he was someone I kind of avoided. Mm. You know what I mean? And you can't assume that in 3 years and 5 years, they're not going to get it together and be killer.
Right.
So talk to them now, one, like a human being with empathy and kindness and respect. Make sure you're not speaking to them in the way that my kind of arrogant self in the past thought of, like, I don't want to do that with such and such, you know?
Yeah.
You have to, like, plan for the fact that, oh God, I would love to be on that Chris Potter gig with you. And if I were still cool with you, it would be like, like, I could at least be in the conversation, you know,
like,
oh man, that would be really, really good. You know? And so that thing of like the relationship and not taking the idea that this person called me for $75. Now my ego is offended that they think I'm worth $75. Mm-hmm. And how dare you? Like, oh God, it's like,
yeah. It goes back to what you said, like, it, you know, it's the best they can do, and you're who they want.
And they're telling you that, yeah.
Right. Bit about your USC years, because we've interviewed many alumni of that program. Who was your primary mentor during your time there? Because there have been so many big drum names that have taught there over the years. Who shaped you there?
That's a really good question. When I entered as a freshman, Greg Field was the drum instructor, mm-hmm. but he was still in the Basie band at the time. Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry. He was still in the Sinatra band at the time. And so had a lot of great, great lessons with Greg, that it opened up my eyes to, again, stuff that I never would have even heard of or dreamt about, when all I really had at the time was my Weco play-alongs, mm-hmm. for, you know, so exposed me to a ton of stuff. And then I became really, really connected early on to the Limerick Park scene, where Billy Higgins had the world stage, mm-hmm. and there was a club called Fifth Street Dicks. And I was a freshman at the time when Trevor Lawrence Jr. was a sophomore. Okay. And it may have been my first week there when I heard Trevor play. And it nearly sent me to the airport. I was like, I need to get out of here. Like, that was, and he is now still a phenomenal, but back then, I guess as a sophomore, you're 19, maybe 20. It was amazing. But Trevor had a connection. Trevor was already a member of kind of the Lombard Park scene around the world stage in Fifth Street Dicks. And through that community, I met Ndugu Chancellor. And I met Ndugu just before he started teaching at USC. I was in some small way a conduit of introducing Ndugu to the USC faculty thing, and then studied with him for a long time. And he was a significant shaping force for on the instrument and his ability to, one of the things that we're talking about, and I didn't understand till later, of like, if you bring Ndugu to your session, everyone's going home happy.
Yep.
Everyone's going home happy. Like, yeah, it doesn't necessarily say the music's going to get played well, because we can already assume everyone can play. You could have called Ndugu, you could have called JR, you could have called, the list goes on and on and on and on. Everyone can play, but everyone's going home having like the Ndugu experience, and they're probably smiling and laughing about something that came out of the experience.
Yeah.
So Ndugu was a significant shaping force for me, and it wasn't until decades later that I found out that Ndugu had also studied with Michael Carvin when he was a young man.
And that's another guy. Like, so many people keep coming back to Carvin. Like, I've studied with Michael a little bit. I've interviewed people who have studied with him in a much more in-depth way. But man, he is one of those, you know, men behind the curtain in the drumming world.
Really, and there's a phrase that I now use in other conversations that I got from you that I really love, where I forget who you were speaking to, where you said like, they only made one of that guy. I really like that saying, and I've now been applying it elsewhere, but yeah, they only made one of that guy.
Yeah.
And so my primary influence at USC, which was a very formative time, was Ndugu. As well as Shelley Berg, who's a phenomenal educator. He was the head of the jazz department at the time. He's a really, really good teacher, mentor, educator type person. And then I had a lot of great teachers there. But then it made so much sense to me when I learned that Ndugu and Carvin had a connection, because Carvin then really shaped and helped me to meet the idea of who I am now. Into introducing the idea of what I do and who I am now to me, and sort of saying like, I think I know who you are. You just don't know who you are yet.
Yeah.
And introducing who I am.
That's really Carvin's thing for sure. Like, he can teach the nuts and bolts of drumming as well as anyone. But his thing with so many people I've talked to is like, they kind of met themselves through Carvin. Even if it were like, I experienced it in just a couple lessons. Like, you know, Carvin is one of those people who can just watch you play and talk to you for a minute and then tell you some fucking truth about yourself. It might be hard to hear, but a lot of it's not always a criticism. It's a lot of times it's aspirational. It's something you haven't thought of. It's something he sees in you that you don't see in yourself. And even if he just like plants that little seed, like you said, it might take decades, but it
took a long time. Yeah. And sort of planted it in Ndugu, who then I found that, and then that set me on a path that eventually brought me back to the tree of the Carvin tree of family students, you know?
Right.
But yeah, he is very, very responsible for, like people say about him, and I don't know how to describe this to anybody, his ability to introduce you to yourself. It sounds mumbo jumbo. It sounds crazy. It sounds like, yeah, whatever, but it's there. And when you look at the students that came from that tree of drumming, that school of drumming, nobody sounds like each other.
Right.
No, they all sound like unique versions of who they are.
And I think that's a hallmark of a great educator. It's true about Carvin. It's true about Peter Erskine. It's true about, you know, Ndugu and Terry Lynn Carrington. It's true about Joe LaBarbera at CalArts. You look at their students and it's like, how did all these people come from that person? And it's an intangible thing about being able to get a person to become themselves, right?
And you mentioned two people that I don't want to go without acknowledging: Terry Lynn, who I spent a lot of time in grad school studying with, mm-hmm. who really opened me up as a drummer and introduced me to some more modern concepts on the instrument that I had maybe traveled as far as like Tony in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And Terry Lynn helped to introduce me really to some stuff beyond that. So it musically, this is now for drummer talk. It was sort of like Tony in the 60s, then jump all the way up to like Cameo and R&B drummers without right. like getting into like R&B and funk and rock drummers without really examining 70s and 80s and things and Wayne records that were coming out. Right. So phenomenal lessons with Terry Lynn that if anyone is entertaining Berkeley and Boston or connecting with her in any way, highly advised, because super intelligent and unique teacher. And then Joe LaBarbera. I had one lesson with Joe LaBarbera because he sent me off with like so much stuff. Yeah. I haven't like really run into him much since, because I'm uh-huh. still, I had one lesson with Joe where we focused on so much Max Roach stuff
yeah.
that he introduced me to Max in a way that I hadn't really looked at Max before, and that was, I haven't been back since because yeah. he gave me enough.
what I love saying yeah. about Joe is that, like, if you need any evidence for how amazing an educator Joe is, Tina Raymond and Gene Coy both came from Joe LaBarbera. Yeah. Like, what the fuck?
That's such a good, yep.
You know?
And that's I was just going to say, that's such a quiet flex as a teacher to be like, I'm going to send these two out and just let them demonstrate. And he will still play like himself without being like, I'm going to show you the ways that I influenced Tina, and I'm going to show you the ways I influenced Joy and everyone in between, and right. Tony, Austin, and yada, yada, you know?
Yeah. Just like, God, he's another one. Jesus. What a wizard he is. Yeah. We'd be remiss if we didn't mention Aaron Serfati as well.
Yeah.
He's another one of those guys.
Who I'm lucky, very, very lucky enough to hire in what I do these days. And Aaron, he's a great example of like, he doesn't need to come out and play these gigs.
Right.
But he is coming. He goes out and plays my gigs. He doesn't play terrible gigs. They're good gigs. He doesn't need to. But I see the level of the people that he's playing with. He's teaching on my gigs.
Mm-hmm.
He's coming in generously, just teaching on the instrument. And I see the language that he brings beginning to expand through the LA community, because these people keep playing gigs with their own and their language and the vocabulary is shifting.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. Yeah. There's a contribution that we make to the scene by just leaving the house and bringing our best selves and doing what we do. Yep. And then if we do even more and bring the professionalism, et cetera, but by bringing a unique thing that Aaron has, there's not a ton of drummers in LA that can speak the language that Aaron has.
For sure.
So he is contributing by just playing these gigs.
That's such a great point about it. Like, yeah, it's a great point about another reason to take a gig. If you're in the position that Aaron is in terms of being an older generation, a burnished resume, just, you know, an OG, you know, there's obviously the self-interest. It's like, I'm going to make X amount of dollars. I'm going to get to play with so-and-so and like have, but you know, if you're in that position, you can, that it is a way of sort of giving back to the community. If you can show up on a gig like that, and like you said, do some teaching on the gig just by being there and being who you are and bringing that experience and bringing that level of performance, that's an investment in the younger generation in your community. That's watering the garden so that everybody in the community has more experiences and better experiences on their gigs.
On April 27th, the Percussive Arts Society Tennessee chapter will present their annual Tennessee Day of Percussion event hosted by Brian Fullen at Trevecca Nazarene University in Nashville, Tennessee, and is open to all drummers and enthusiasts. This incredible event features solo competitions in drum set, concert snare drum, and mallet keyboard. Online registration is now open to everyone who wants to participate. Visit PAS Tennessee chapter on Facebook or Instagram to scan the QR code to register for this event. The competitions, or to register your percussion ensemble for the showcase. Grand prizes will be awarded to the contest winners, with door prizes raffled throughout the day. Sponsors include Yamaha, Zildjian, Remo, Innovative Percussion, Ludwig, Sabian, and many more. There will be clinics and performances throughout the day featuring Matt Billingsley, currently on the Eras Tour with Taylor Swift, marimba virtuoso and international soloist Andre Vinay, Bob Breithaupt, recognized as one of the nation's leaders in percussion education, and Keith Elio, director of percussion at the Interlochen Center for the Arts and consultant for the Avidus Zildjian Company. Ben Lupton from the Music City Mystique will also present a drumline clinic featuring the Victory Drumline, and Jeremy Chapman will present clinics on Irish drumming. Additionally, there will be collegiate and high school education ensemble showcases throughout the day, featuring the Tennessee All-State Percussion Ensemble. You don't want to miss this incredible opportunity to learn from world-class players and educators. Registration is now open. Tickets will also be available at the door, with registration opening at 8:30 a.m. day of event. Credit card only. Final reminder, visit PAS Tennessee Chapter on Facebook or Instagram to scan the QR code to register.
And it's so needed. We so need it. And that comes back to, again, there's this one thing that I'm very concerned about that I see sometimes, and this still comes from me coming from a place of starvation, is like judging someone for taking a gig. You know, like there is plenty of $50 gigs that came in just in time when I needed them. And
yep.
Like there's plenty, you know, so I'm not going to, my younger self is still in the position of like, I'm not going to let someone tell me that I can't, that I can finally stop sleeping in my car this week because I took that one more gig that gave me the deposit to get into the thing. You know, like we cannot judge people. And similarly, someone like Aron, like someone might say, why is he bringing such like, why is he bringing this Ferrari to the Toyota convention? Like, why is he playing this gig? But he's doing it because he has his reasons for doing it. He's being generous, he's being giving, and he's elevating those around him. And at the same time, we as people who make teaching as part of what we do, we can't say to people, you just got to get on the bandstand. You just got to get experience. Some stuff, you just got to get out there and play. There's few things that are more important than playing. Oh, but don't take that gig. And shame on you for taking that gig, and shame on, like, it's just, we all need to, we all have to have a certain belief and faith if we're going to participate in a capitalistic system, which we can either participate or not participate. You can bone out if you want, but you are here in this capitalistic system. So leverage it to your advantage and understand that, like, if you have something that is of extreme value, that value will find its way to you. Mm-hmm. That price point, those funds will find their way to you. But at the same time, values change. If the marketplace doesn't value that certain skill set that it used to value in 1995, if the value of that thing, because every year schools are popping out people who can play, every year there's more and more people, there is a supply issue existence in our business that didn't exist in 1999 when I first moved to New York. There is a significant difference in supply. And at the same time, there is a significant general lowering in the standards expected by the audience.
Yep.
Not every audience by any means, but there's a lowering of what they're really looking for out there. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, there's competition for just entertainment. There's Netflix. Stay home, watch some Netflix.
Yeah.
That the club owner's feeling that. There's restaurants are far more popular now. Chefs are celebrities, are, you know, someone may decide to go and get the restaurant experience that's more about the experience than the food these days in various places instead of going to a jazz, you know.
Right.
And they might choose to do that instead of going to the jazz club, which was about the experience with mediocre food. Now they're going to go to that. And so all that to say, we have to acknowledge that nothing lasts forever. Carvin, nothing lasts forever. Mm-hmm. Things will change. Nothing lasts forever. The values that used to exist at once upon a time it's not worth the same anymore. There's lots of things have changed, but that doesn't mean we can't make money. I happen to believe that like money is actually kind of relatively easy to make, but you just have to know where people are willing to pay money for something.
Right. Like, I like what you said not judging people for taking the $50 gig, because there are all kinds of reasons that people will take a $50 gig. Earlier you sort of illustrated how if you're offered a $50 gig, you know, if you're lucky, you don't need that $50. And if that's the case, there are all kinds of ways that you can sort of strategize and triangulate and create more relationships out of that. But sometimes, like, you really need the fucking $50 and you just got to go make it no matter what. You know, another thing Bobby Watson told us is as a professional musician, your music, your talent is both your offense and your defense. It is your sword and your shield. And sometimes you get to use it to get to where you want to go, but other times you have to like literally use it to just fight off starvation.
Yeah. Big time. Yeah.
So that has to balance with, this is another thing we've been talking about recently. And like, you have to balance that with, on the one hand, there's take every gig, get the experience, make the money, you know, every gig. And on the other hand, if you do that too much, you can get burnt out and you can also become a jack of all trades and a master of none and not know who you are as a musician, as a drummer. So you have to balance. You're pointing at yourself right now. That happened.
Man, big time.
It happened to me too. It absolutely happened to me. So,
and that's starvation thing created it in me.
Right.
That starvation thing of like, what do you need?
Yep.
What do you need? I will bring it. I will figure out how to bring it and I will do that thing. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of time in that mindset. And there was no time to think about like who I am and what's my sound.
Yeah.
And then as a little aside, this may or may not be helpful to younger drummers. Add on to that, one of the worst things that ever happened to me, grab yourself for a jazz drummer, largely a jazz drummer, grab yourself a cymbal endorsement and you don't really have a sound. Oh God, that ruined me. That was terrible. Cause then I just suddenly had a room full of cymbals and like, I love when I get to play my Bill Stewart stuff on my Bill Stewart ride. I love when I get to play my K-Wash stuff on my bounce ride. I love when I get to play. And then now my willingness to be whatever you need was supplied with infinite instruments and terrible, like really terrible. So that's a great point about like, for just, and be that, careful of.
It's a great point about the instruments you play, because like, you know, you're coming at it from a place of like, it's the opposite of starvation, right? You've got all these instruments. You can sound like anybody
suddenly.
But I think a much more useful exercise is to, you know, yeah, like you can switch out a cymbal or two. Yeah, you can tune the drums different or change the heads or whatever. But like, if you can sort of keep the sounds you work with in a smaller scope and figure out how to make work in a few different, you know, they're not going to work for everything, obviously. But just talking about finding your sound and finding like what you give a shit about as a drummer. Like if you can kind of pare down the options so that your sound comes from you, not from the instruments.
Yep. I'm to this day still, I'm a little sound obsessed, you know, like mm-hmm. I played a gig last night that the room didn't love the ride cymbal. Mm-hmm. And I forced myself to just bring one ride cymbal to that room, because there were times when I'd show up with five or six ride cymbals to make sure I had the ride cymbal that the room liked, you know what I mean? But I'm still to this day I really admire people who, there's one of my absolute musical heroes, one of the most professional people and drummers I've ever engaged and know of that you've interviewed, Steve Haas, who can play on the same instrument. He can play so many styles and so many sounds.
Yep.
And he just locks it in and it sounds phenomenal. And at least as far as I can tell, I've been lucky enough to have him on hundreds of gigs. As far as I can tell, nothing's bothering him. He's in a good spot. And mm-hmm. he's that same instrument, same set of cymbals, a a crash might change.
Yeah.
But like he can deliver so many sounds and so many styles. We'll go from tipping during dinner to slamming during dance party.
Yeah.
And so I still am jealous and really admire people who are able to do that. But that's another example of like, no matter what happens, you're going to get premium service when a guy like that is on the bandstand.
Right.
Doesn't matter the gig.
Right.
You are going to get premium service. And that is a brand. He's in the drumming world, he's a legend. But as time goes by here in Los Angeles, I hire other bands that he has played with and I hear him in the band. You know what
yep.
I mean? When
yep.
when he's not on the gig, I hear his influence on the band.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I hear
heavy.
The Haas-isms, the Haas arrangements. That's how much of an influence, and deservedly so, an influence he's had on the thing. And that's the type of thing that will keep someone working. That's the type of thing that will like keep someone busy. No matter what happens. There's not going to be, there's nights off if they want them, but you know.
Well, man, this was so great. I really appreciate you reaching out, and there's so much we've talked about here that I think is going to be really useful and actionable to a lot of people, because we talk all the time about, you know, how to create work for yourself, and we talk about creating relationships, but there's, you know, those are kind of abstract ideas, and I think you've illustrated really well what to do, how it's done,
my biggest takeaway I'd ask people to consider is like, you're in the people business.
Mm-hmm.
You're in the people human people business,
right?
And if you stay focused on that, every there's a lot of great players, you know. There's that.
Yeah.
If you operate from the assumption of like everyone can play, especially to the demands of what most gigs are happening these days. The general level of the talent pool is very high.
Yes.
Everyone can play. But remembering, you know, the thing that can set you apart is that you are dealing with humans, you're dealing with the business of people, and by keeping people associating you with, I can count on this person to send everyone home happy, that they're going to make my band sound great. The people in the room are going to feel like that band sounds great. They're all happy. They're all smiling. You know, our job as drummers, this is getting a little long, but our job as drummers, we make that band sound and look so great so that the band gets hired again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The band leader may call a different drummer, but if the audience is like, this band makes me happy, that's
right.
All the audience knows.
Yep.
They make me happy because they're smiling. So like Bobby Watson will take a 2-hour van ride and he will fill up every minute of a 2-hour van ride with jokes and have everyone cracking up. And then you're walking into sound check smiling and happy and feeling good instead of like, oh, 2 hours in the van.
Right.
You know, you're walking into sound check in a good spot, you know,
yeah.
And the band has a vibe and you guys are going to have a great gig.
And it's not always about being the life of the party. Like, so, you know, some people like Bobby are just, you know, natural extroverts and do that. But, you know, those of us who don't have it in us to be the life of every party and the mayor of every town, you know, there are still ways that we deliver value. And it's about being positive. It's about being respectful. It's about being professional and developing genuine relationships and bringing your real best self, whatever that looks
like.
That's very important.
So just to piggyback, like doesn't have to be, I'm not supernaturally extroverted, but I can turn it on and I go home exhausted, but I go home, I'm tired as all, but your real best self might be finding a moment to pull the band leader aside and being like, you did a great job tonight. You made my job so easy. The set list was great. I saw that you had to manage this, that, and the other. You know, when such and such walked in late, you kept them comfortable. I'm just letting you know, you did a fantastic job tonight. And I really respect that you put this all together. You could, and then coming back around, you could have called a ton of drummers for this gig. Thank you for calling me.
Yep.
I appreciate it. And I see the work you're doing. Dude, that guy's going home. He's going to remember that conversation forever.
For sure.
If you mean it, Yeah. And if you mean it, you're a great human being because you're paying attention to them. You know?
Yes. And like, that resonates so, yeah. That resonates with me in particular, because one of the things I've learned about myself is like in my younger years, like just as a performer, I used to think that my machine ran on applause. Right. And it is, you know, a room full of people clapping for you is great. It's very, very nice. But what I've learned about myself over the years is that what I value even more than 1,000 people standing up clapping is one person coming up to me and saying, man, you sounded great. Like one person goes out of their way. Yeah. Yeah. So if you can kind of be that, if you can be that to other people, it's part of creating relationships. If you don't know somebody from Adam, but you see them play and you're like, holy shit, that dude's a monster. Like, say so, right? You don't have to like sell them a bill of goods. You can just go up to him and say, man, I love the way you play.
Yep. And thank you for being generous enough to play that way tonight.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because it's very easy for someone to go into shoemaker mode and chat, but there's nothing wrong with that. But if the music is asking for more and the person isn't willing to give more, like, so thank you for being willing to give tonight. Yeah. Like, I heard it. That connected to me. Thank you for being generous.
Yeah.
I really hope that for your podcast, the Working Drummer Podcast, that I know the feeling of struggling with money and work and what we do out there. And I don't want people to feel like you can't make money doing this.
Yeah.
It's just money is actually not that hard to make. You can do it. Just remember you're in the people business and make people feel great. And that's going to make the band look and sound great. And the phone will ring and someone is going to say like, that band might be more expensive, but boy, do my customers like them.
Mm-hmm.
Off we go. You know? Wow. So thanks, Zach.
Yeah. Thanks so much, man. Really great talking to you, and best wishes on everything you're doing, playing and booking and otherwise.
Exactly. I'm halfway through your interview with Ulysses right now, so I'm looking forward to going and finishing that. Like, thanks for doing what you do. I love
some
what you're
shit
doing,
to
man.
Say.
He's got some stuff, and you're really good at, and I mean this, you're really good at what you do. You're a great conversationalist. Interviews, journalism is a skill. I don't know if you consider yourself a journalist, but you have developed the skill of a journalist with great follow-up questions, with great listening skills and the ability to further the conversation along. Like, for all I know, you could have a degree in journalism, but you've developed a skill and it's cool to see.
I don't, man. You know? Thank you for saying so, man. I really appreciate that. That means a lot coming from you.
Keep on going and hope to see you soon.
Thanks again to Rob Perkins. Hope that was insightful and useful to a lot of you. Lots to think about and hopefully act on there. Next week, Matt Krause will be talking with Emmanuel Cervantes, an LA-based drummer who tours with pop star Andy Grammer. Hope you check that out. Until then, stay safe, stay sane, play pretty, and thanks for listening. Cheers.